Welcome, everyone, to the first episode of the Unbox Some Fun Cast. I am one of your hosts, Kylie, and I'm joined today by...
Chandra.
So this is our first official episode, and the way that we plan this podcast to go is to alternate more scripted, very tightly focused episodes with some more freeform, which we like to do when we're chatting at the store. And this is going to be a more scripted episode about curating a game selection at a game store. So this podcast is about running a game store. It's for anyone interested in running a game store, for anyone in the games industry that wants to know how do games get into a game store. And we're just hoping it'll be something you enjoy. Before we get into curating a selection at a game store, figure since this is our first episode, a little bit of background on who we are and how we ended up at Games Unlimited. I'm going to turn it over to Chandra to start us off there.
Yeah. So interestingly, I have been with Games Unlimited for longer than Kylie has, despite the fact that he is now the owner of the store. I grew up hating board games until my parents felicitously ran across a copy of HeroQuest and got it for me for Christmas when I was in fifth grade. And I don't remember asking for it. It's possible that I saw a commercial on TV and said, that looks neat, but whatever it was, my parents thought it looked like something I would be into, and boy, were they right. So my friends and I played a bunch of HeroQuest, and the next year when we went to middle school, we met more kids who were feeding in from different elementary schools, and so we got exposed to different things. And one of the things we got exposed to was Magic the Gathering, which I immediately took a disliking to. Although I loved the art and still do to this day, but wasn't into the game or the collecting thing. But I also discovered role-playing games from another kid who was coming in to my middle school. And my first role-playing game was Rifts from Palladium Books. Some of you may know that as like the kitchen sink RPG, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, the whole shebang. This friend that I met in sixth grade referred me to Games Unlimited in Squirrel Hill as the game store he knew of where he got his gaming stuff. So I bullied my mother into driving me across the river to Squirrel Hill. And at Games Unlimited, I got my first copy of the Rifts core book and my first set of dice. And that was it. Bob Schwartz, the original owner of the store, talked to my mother, reassured her that it's only smart, creative kids that are into these games and they don't ruin your life. And hand wave, I never finished a degree. And after living elsewhere for a while, I came back to Pittsburgh in 2008 in my early mid-20s. And was looking for a job and happened to just be walking the streets of Squirrel Hill because that's where my friends and I were sharing a house at the time, and walked into Games Unlimited for a nostalgia hit and just asked while I was in, hey, do you happen to be hiring? And Jim, the guy who was managing the store at the time, said, as a matter of fact, yes. He gave me an on-the-spot interview, told me to show up whatever day and time, I don't remember. I did, and that's kind of that. And when Kylie took over first as manager and then eventually as owner, you asked me, hey, can you come on with this as your regular gig, as your main job? And at the time that was very attractive, and I said yeah. And you know, I've just been kind of here growing with the store ever since. I've been a customer with Games Unlimited for 30 years. I bought Rifts and my first set of dice when I was 12.
I have to say, you are now probably about the age Bob was when he had that conversation with your yeah. mother. You have had similar conversations with parents.
I have. Yeah, I have had those same conversation with parents saying, hey, think about all the skills, all the real life skills that role-playing games and board games help you to develop.
Everything comes full circle.
Right.
I'm very happy. I've gone out of my way to make sure I can keep Chandra and keep him happy. He's an integral part of Games Unlimited. I myself, I was a big video game kid. Once I got to high school, I did discover a cohort of people that introduced me to Dungeons and Dragons. I hadn't really read fantasy. They gave me some Dragonlance books, started a D&D campaign. That was around the time Magic the Gathering came out. That was hugely popular. I didn't really continue with tabletop gaming post high school. Went to graduate school for philosophy. I wanted to be a philosophy professor. Academia wasn't really working out just the way the job market was. So I decided I need to do something different. I had just moved to Pittsburgh. I had just gotten married and was really into the Battlestar Galactica TV show. Heard there was a board game. Picked up that board game. And big, heavy game. Not what I'd recommend for someone's first tabletop game. Taught my friends. We played a ton of it. But eventually wanted something a little easier, something I could play just two players with my partner and I, and walked into Games Unlimited, where I believe it was Chandra behind the counter who recommended Carcassonne. Scott Carcassonne, and that just started me down a path. I wanted to play every single game out there. I was working at a coffee shop. I had not finished my dissertation. I was looking for direction in my life. And eventually, through coming into Games Unlimited, got to know Bob Schwartz, the owner, who took a shine to me, recognized something in me. And I sort of sheepishly said to my partner one day, hey, maybe I should open a game store. Let's just go full entrepreneur. This seems like something fun to do. And she recommended I talk to Bob, which I was like, I don't want to step on his toes. But when I mentioned to Bob this idea, you know, he was getting up in years. He was ready to retire. He said, you've got an energy. You've got a passion. Why don't you come in? I'll teach you how to run and manage the store and then eventually sell it to you. So that was the plan. Though we like to apocryphally say one of two things. Either sometimes I say, you know, I couldn't decide what to buy at Games Unlimited, so I just bought the store. But other times I say Chandra was such a good salesperson that he sold me the entire store. Be careful when you come into Games Unlimited talking to Chandra. You'll walk out with more than you expected. I officially purchased the store from Bob in 2015. And coda to that story, Bob is the adopted grandparent to my two children. He purchased the house across the street from me. He lives across the street. We play games with him regularly. He watches the kids. He's still a big part of the life and loves what's happened to Games Unlimited.
We plan in a future episode of this podcast to get more into the history of Games Unlimited as well. So yes. Stay tuned for that.
Yes. I've already talked to Bob. He will be on.
Excellent.
The subject of today's episode is curating a selection. What does it mean to curate a selection? The games we have on our shelves are carefully chosen.
Yeah.
We are not just, hey, what's the top 10 on Board Game Geek? Hey, which games have, you know, made the most money on crowdfunding, which RPGs are, you know, is everybody talking about? Give me a list and bring that in. We're not doing something that basically an AI could do.
Yeah.
Go out and decide what the top games are. So why do we do that and how do we do that? It's sort of the subject of this particular episode. Let's start with what does it mean to actually curate a selection? You have some thoughts on that, Chandra?
Yeah, I mean, in general terms, it's just like curating your collection of art and decor at home. It's making really deliberate choices about what you have available for people to take a look at. You're making choices about the kinds of customers you're trying to draw in. You're making choices about the tone you set for the store and all of these things. It's very layered when we talk about curation. It's a more involved process than a lot of people might think. Like you said, it's not just pick the 10 hottest games. Sure, we'll look at that list and that'll be part of our decision-making process, but it's also got to be what are the right games from that list of 10 to go with all of the other things we choose to bring in to suit our tastes, the tastes of our customers and our community.
One of the reasons I think this is a fantastic first episode, curation is actually one of our mission, vision, and values. We've sat down over really like a week's worth of time and really charted out what we want Games Unlimited to be. And one of the things that came out of that are our three uniques. What are the things that we think maybe individually, any of these three things are not unique to us, but that combination of three things is one of the things that makes Games Unlimited unique and makes us successful so that we can constantly refer back to that and focus on it. And one of those three uniques is an expansive, varied, and curated selection.
Yes.
Like the word curation is right there. We recognized that it was important. If we stop hand selecting every item that's in the store, that means we're sort of losing track of our vision.
Absolutely.
So we really have to focus.
Absolutely. Because even the mistakes are part of the curation process. And I think overall improve the experience of the store.
Absolutely. The other part of our mission, vision, values is what our process is and what we've outlined as our proven process is selection, curation, and interaction.
Yep.
Meaning, I mean, selection is part of curation, but then continuing to refine that curation and using that, using our knowledge of it to interact with customers.
Yep.
And that is a big part of it. Because we curate, we have the ability to hand sell our products.
Mm-hmm.
This is a difference between selling a game versus stocking a game.
Right. There's a huge, huge difference between just having stuff on your shelves that people are welcome to come in and put money down for compared to having things on the shelves that people on staff can have an intelligent conversation about. So much of our customer interactions are soliciting information from the customers, trying to figure out what will make them happy, what will please the audience that they're taking their games home to, rather than just what's the hot thing, what's the expensive thing, what's the fancy looking thing.
We usually have three people in the store at any one time. And so if a particular game one person doesn't know, someone else may know a little bit more about it. Have an understanding. Why did we bring that in? What was cool about it? So if someone asks about that, in addition to, as Chandra said, getting the feedback from the customer themselves. I'm looking for something that does X, Y, Z. Well, we know all these games. We have the knowledge of these games on our shelves because they're not just sitting there. They're not just stocked based on some list. We know what they are.
It's also more and more opportunities for interacting with our customers, interacting with our community, because when I'm selling someone a game, I'm not just putting it in their hands and walking away. I'm asking those questions. And sometimes it's a game I haven't played yet. Sometimes it's a game that just came out or someone else picked to come into the store and I haven't interacted with it yet. So that's an opportunity to talk to the customer and say, hey, let's go learn more about this game together. Even if I don't yet have the expertise on that particular game, we can use that as yet another opportunity to interact with the people that walk in and build those kind of friendly relationships with them.
And, you know, because we're so focused on that interaction, that community, that having that conversation, it's important that the stuff on our shelves are things that we are interested in.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't mention this at the top of the episode, but we are a store that focuses on board games and role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
We don't sell miniatures-focused games. We don't sell collectible card games. And a large part of the reason for that is that's not something our staff is interested in, right? If we sold those things, we would want to be able to have meaningful interactions with customers around them. So they need to be things that we're excited about.
Yeah.
Curation is keeping things that everyone on staff is excited about. Not only is knowledgeable about, but is excited about.
Yeah.
Because that's what creates those moments of interaction and joy and energy with people in the
store. It's also how we take best advantage of the knowledge and skills of our staff. I will use myself as an example here. There was a period of time during which Games Unlimited did not carry RPGs. And if you walk in now, you would find that really hard to believe. Our RPG selection is fairly large and fairly broad and deep. But there was that period when we just didn't carry them. And Kylie came back from a trade show and said he was thinking about bringing in RPGs. He had gone to a seminar about selling RPGs in your game store. And one of the things they said at the seminar was that to do that effectively, you need to have a real RPG nerd on staff. You need to have someone who just loves RPGs, knows a good bit about them, and is happy to continue learning about them rather than just focusing on the same RPG over and over again. And he was like, hey, Lightbulb, I have one of those. And so he came back to me and said, what do you think about bringing RPGs into the store? Can you help me curate that selection? And we can do that with so many categories of games in our store because of our staff and their varied interests. So even within the categories of board games and RPGs, which people who don't know those categories as well might think are very limited, because there actually is so much internal diversity in those categories, it allows us to really parlay the skills and knowledge of our staff and integrate our staff more fully into our day-to-day operations.
Absolutely. We sell magic tricks now because we have a staff member who literally runs the Society of American Magicians Pittsburgh chapter. Yep.
Yeah.
And he was like, this is what I'm passionate about. Does it fit in Games Unlimited? I don't know. Let's find out. So we've started bringing in magic tricks. Staff have started learning magic tricks. And again, we're curating now something completely outside of what we were thinking of, but it creates interaction.
Yeah.
And it creates another part that I think is huge to your curation, which is, what is the tone of your store? The products you have on your shelves set a tone, right? And I've said this to many retailers over the years. If you are focused on Warhammer and you've got, you know, big cutouts of Space Marines in your windows, that's awesome. That is going to set a tone. It's going to draw a certain type of clientele in. And you have to think about that. Who are you trying to draw in? Because a lot of times those stores say, well, I want to get more families in. I want to get into some of these, you know, family weight cooperative board games and get people to enjoy that. How does what you have on the shelves set a tone that makes that successful?
Yeah.
The way a person's going to feel when they walk into the store for the first time, if they see mostly historical war games, is different than how they're going to feel when they walk in for the first time and they see mostly family games from HABA, which is different from how they're going to feel if they walk in and see mostly collectible card games. I don't know a ton about miniatures, but I would love miniatures game systems that weren't combat-based, right? So much of them are about fighting, and fighting's fine and everything, but if you have so much stuff in your store that's about fighting, that creates a different tone, a different mindset than if we see so many cozy games, anthropomorphic animals engaging in cozy activities. It's a very different store when you look around and see a lot of that. So what you bring in, you do have to make that decision. Is this something that's going to fit with the vibe of my store?
It almost sounds paradoxical in a way, or maybe redundant is the better word, right? You think walking into a game store, of course there's going to be play going on in a game store, but play doesn't equal playfulness. And I think that's one thing that we do really well, is we have a kind of light, playful kind of atmosphere in our store, largely because of the kinds of games we choose to make front and center. Now, especially if you go to the heavier strategy game section, which is a large section of our store, or the RPG section, yeah, you'll see some like dark fantasy art. You'll see some dark sci-fi looking stuff. There's kind of this back and forth play between this like hardcore dungeon delving stuff versus is, you know, like your Cairn or Outcast Silver Raiders or whatever in the RPG section, over against, say, Ryutama, which is a very light, breezy looking RPG. And they can be right there next to each other. And that is, in an interesting way, kind of the tone we're setting. We want people to see that they have options and that, look, there's something you can bring to your adult friends and there's something you can bring home to your kids. And everyone is going to be able to have a good time and have that sense of play and whimsy in a lot of different directions.
Something that we should discuss just briefly, because a lot of people don't realize this, is how many games there actually are out there. How many solicitations we get. When I say solicitation, I'm talking about like an email that says, hey, here's a new game project. Do you want to carry it? When I started doing this almost 15 years ago now, it was the case that it was, you know, two or three games a week that we could bring in. You literally could just bring in all the new stuff that was coming in. Now, my solicitations weekly, like just emails going through between board games and RPGs, it's easily got to be 100+ things that I could pre-order or bring in.
Yeah.
That's clearly not curation if I brought all that stuff in. But I'm going to look now at just one email of a pre-order solicitation from one of my distributors. Well over 100 things on this. I go through those lists and I see names and I have to make conscious decisions to dig a little deeper or leave it behind. The numbers that we hear nowadays are anywhere from 2,500 to 5,000 new board game releases a year. Mm-hmm. And at Games Unlimited, we bring in probably about a dozen a week. RPGs, I tried to find some metrics on that one, Chandra, and I don't know if you have some, but the metrics I found were like something like 3,500 Kickstarter or crowdfunding RPG projects go live a year.
Yeah. It's a little difficult even to get the numbers for RPGs because so much of it is going to be supplements and adventure yes. modules and stuff like that.
We regularly every week order from, I would say, four distributors. Like three major board game distributors. We probably do a weekly order with Indie Press Revolution for RPGs.
Yep. Increasingly, we're doing almost weekly orders with Studio 2 as well. Mm. Another sort of
which is another
smaller press RPG distro.
And those are a combination of reordering stuff that we've had, but also getting new stuff in.
That's not even counting our direct orders. And we're doing more and more of those these days as well, yes. on top of our distro.
We have well over 100 direct order accounts that, you know, we sift through and we're getting solicitations from. All of which is to say there's a lot. So how do we determine what to bring in? Yeah. Is it hot? Is it hyped? Are people talking about it? Right? And we talked about that at the top. We don't just bring in what's hot. I don't go to Board Game Geek and go to the hotness list and just bring things in.
Hotness is a starting place. More than anything, it's not the decision-making factor on its own, but it's a great way to have things sort of kicked up into your field of awareness. There's the national and international, like BGG hotness or whatever, but there's also local hotness when customers are hyped about something that's upcoming. And that's a really important aspect, too.
Here in Pittsburgh, we are very close to several major national conventions, Gen Con and Origins, that a lot of our customers go to, and sometimes we go to, but hearing them talk when they come back from something like that about what is hot to them. And that's really a second part of it, which is just customers asking about it. You know, if they've heard of it from some way, shape, or form, it puts it on our radar. Mm-hmm. Hotness is often an indicator that a publisher is putting some marketing dollars behind it. Yeah. And that makes our job easier.
Yeah.
Right. We don't want to just stock things for sure. But when I'm telling someone about a game, if they've heard of it already, that like gets you halfway.
Yeah.
halfway to a sale, halfway to the interest. They're like, oh yeah, tell me more about this because I've heard of it somewhere.
Right.
They may not even know where. It just gets in the zeitgeist.
It can double back on you, though, if you're not careful.
I can also give you an example, and I never like to talk bad about any specific game, but sometimes it happens. We don't crowdfund much anymore, but, you know, we used to bring in a lot of crowdfunded projects, and I would look at, oh, it's done millions. It's got, you know, 10,000 backers. Sure, let's get on that train without doing a lot of research. And I remember a game, again, I apologize to the publisher, but we brought in Botany. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Absolutely
beautiful
gorgeous.
Game. Yeah. I mean, one of the top 10 most beautiful
looked
games
like
I've ever seen in my
life.
Looked like
a book of, you know, like Victorian plants and flowers, just gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it had hotness. We had people asking us about it. And it was a Kickstarter, so we brought in, I don't remember, with Kickstarters, it gets difficult because we often have to bring in large amounts because we don't know when we're going to get more of it. But I remember it came in. I was like, cool, I'm going to take this home. I'm going to try it. I'm excited. I didn't even play the game because I read the rules. And it just looked like a roll and move. It did not look like something I could be excited to tell my customers they should play.
Yep.
And that puts us in an odd position because we're trying to curate. We want to be able to talk about things that we like. And this game had just come in and it fell completely flat. It was a Kickstarter campaign. I didn't read the rule book ahead of time. I didn't do anything. And honestly, I probably would have brought it in anyway, just based on the hype. But yeah. We've learned that, what do I do in that situation?
Yeah,
I'm usually up front. We tell customers, hey, this is a beautiful, beautiful game. Don't think it plays very well, but may fit for your group, you know. And we eventually sold through it, but it wasn't one we brought back in because it wasn't something we wanted to have to apologize for, if you will,
yeah,
when selling to a customer.
Yeah. We always ask customers, kind of a call to action when we interact with customers is, hey, you know, this game you just bought, next time you come in, let us know how it went. It helps us to help that customer better in the future. Because maybe they took home a game we consider to be really great, but it just didn't work for them. Or they took home something, hey, I haven't played this yet, but you're clearly excited to buy it and take it home. Next time you come in, let me know your experience to help educate me about it. Whatever it is, but it feels awful when a customer comes in and says, so that game I bought last time, I took it home, played it with my family, played it with my friends, and it did not click at all with us. It feels really bad when that happens, yeah. You know?
It does. But we take that as an opportunity to learn, as you said, because that's actually information. We'll try to figure out why didn't it work for that person. And when we're talking about it with customers in the future, we'll say, hey, we do know people that have had a negative experience, you know, maybe it had to do with their group, maybe it had to do with this, but we want that to be part of the decision-making process before someone buys the game, yeah. Because we're going to hear things good and bad.
If you ask me my thoughts on a game, and this is something we encourage in all of the staff, you know, mm-hmm. If you ask me my thoughts on a game, I will give you my honest opinion on that game. I will never, you know, I'll never hand wave a negative experience with a game. That doesn't mean I'm going to tell you this game is awful because I had a bad experience with it, but I'll tell you. And it's the same thing with games that if I have three customers buy a game and all come back and tell me that was mediocre at best, then, you know, that's yeah. going to become part of the conversations I have with future customers.
As a retail store, things are best when we bring in a small amount until we've played it. Mm-hmm. And even if we have played it, maybe we played it at a show or something, until we've talked to customers about it, until we've sold it to customers and gotten their feedback on it, it's hard for us to want to go really deep.
Yeah.
This is why hype and hotness is not the be-all end-all. It's a starting point, but until it comes in, until we can see if we're excited about it, and even if we're excited about it, we have games like Poor Adrenaline that we love that don't seem to hit with customers. They don't pick it up.
Our hype, you know, you talk about bringing in just a few until we get hands on it and get to try it and form our own opinion. Game stores, if they are smart, if they're really doing their jobs well, we are tastemakers in this hobby. And that doesn't mean everyone's going to agree with us all the time, and we don't want or need them to, but it does mean hype is not just customer hype. Hype is not just industry hype. Hype is also us. Hype is what we get excited about, because customers are going to see our genuine excitement when we're talking about something. When we are talking about a game and we are getting animated and our voices are getting louder and we've got smiles on our faces and twinkles in our eyes, customers see that. And that speaks to, you know, the humanity between us. And that gets people to say, man, if you're this excited about this, there's got to be something in there. You know, there's got to be something worth experiencing. And that's like a really positive aspect of hype, is when I am standing there with a customer or with several customers, with a family that came in together, and we're all getting excited together. That's the really positive side of that mechanism, I think.
Other big factors, looking at these solicitations of stuff, maybe it doesn't have hype yet, but we look at the designer, we look at the publisher, right? We have relationships with them, not only personally, we have like history of how well their games sell. If a particular publisher's games are always selling well, always exciting for us, they got a new project coming out, probably bringing it in. Possibly even sight unseen.
It's very much like with books. You know, I think a lot of people new to this hobby don't think about designer initially. But once you have a few games under your belt, you start noticing that name under the title and start paying more attention to it. Because it's just like, you know, if you have a favorite fantasy author, you know they have a style. You know they have a feel to their writing. Even if the subject matter changes radically from one novel series to the next, you still know there's something in there you can count on that gets you intrigued.
And this is where curation comes in again, both curation and knowledge. When we're talking to a customer and they say, hey, I really liked Sushi Go. Well, one place you can go is other drafting games, or maybe let's show you some food games. But you can also say, the designer of that game is Phil Walker Hardig. He's a great designer and has done a lot of games in that weight. Let me show you some other games by that designer.
Right.
Right? Because we are carrying them. I'm going to pull up, and if you want to do that too, John, I'm just going to go to literally our website, gamesunl.com, plug. But I'm going to the coming soon page. The reason I want to go here is just, I want to look at a couple of them and show why did we decide to bring this in, right? This is a game that's not out yet. We don't know how it's going to do, but we've pre-ordered it. The first thing I see actually is this game called Spooktacular. From Level 99.
I'm excited about that one.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both saw that at Gamma, I believe, Gamma Expo this past year. Publisher was there, had a copy of the game. I think it was on Kickstarter at the time or had just come off. But, you know, was able to quickly show us, hey, there's different monsters. You're all, I think, different monsters trying to create fear in the movie theater. These are sort of B-movie thing. And it looked whimsical, but fun. The pieces were very cool. And again, the sort of thing, none of us played it. I don't even think we got a demo of it. It was just out. But it created excitement for us. So it's like, keep that in mind. And then when I saw a solicitation for it, because there was no way to pre-order it at the time. Like I said, I think it might have been on Kickstarter. But I saw a solicitation come through. Yes, that game looks exciting. Let's bring a few in and see how it does. I mean, I see a Warhammer fantasy book on here. I have no idea why we would bring that in.
Yep, there's no one on staff who plays it or regularly GMs a campaign, so totally wasted space on that one.
Yeah. As I scroll down, I will talk about an example of just hotness and hype. We've got the Cosmere RPG. This is based on the Brandon Sanderson books, which I will say I'm a fan of. I'm currently reading some of the Stormlight Archive. But this is brought in purely based on hype. I mean, this was the biggest RPG crowdfunded campaign ever. It's something like $15 million. It's unbelievable. I don't know how the RPG plays. It is a licensed RPG, which we may talk a little bit about that in the future. But I will say part of my sense with this is something that may not be picked up solely by RPG fans. Like, people are such ravenous fans of the author, Brandon Sanderson, and his books, and they just want more of that content. And I think this may be picked up by people who just want more of that content, right? So
that's the thing with licensed RPGs. You know, I have plenty of thoughts on that particular topic, but one thing that they tend to do really well is serve as a source book about the setting of, you know, whatever property it is, you know, movies, TV shows, novels. They tend to help fill out details of a setting. And so even for fans of that property who don't play RPGs, it might be worth having this book because it will be a reference guide to that world. There's usually an extensive setting chapter, you know, that will have a lot of details about that world. So it serves as a reference book in addition to a game.
And what it does for the curation, right? Again, I'm a fan of Sanderson's work. I don't plan to ever play the Cosmere RPG, but much like the Mistborn board game, right? That has created so many conversations with customers. People come in, have no idea there's a Mistborn board game, mm-hmm. but they're fans of the novels. And since we have people on staff who have also read some of that, it creates an interaction. And that's part of what curation does. As I'm going through our coming soon list, so much of it is stuff that we saw at cons.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting. That puts us on the other side of the equation. Because normally we're the people educating our customers about games or mm-hmm. trying to instill our excitement for a thing to our customers. But going to cons and trade shows lets us be on the other side. We get to be, you know, sort of emotionally swayed, but in a fun way, watching the twinkle in the eye of the designer or publisher.
There's stuff that we don't bring in. A lot of time it's just whatever it is, I see it in line. I don't even click to go further. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily there's a conscious, I researched this game extensively and decided it's not for us. We don't have time to research everything extensively.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's things that we intentionally decide not to bring in. Mm-hmm. An example that I'll give, you know, recently we got the new iteration of Quacks of Quedlinburg, which is just called Quacks now. One of my all-time favorite games. Love that game. We carry the base of Quacks, but we could also get, there's a deluxe version that has like upgraded pieces. There's an all-in version, I think, that has the upgraded pieces and both expansions, right? I made the intentional choice not to bring those other two in, mostly because it creates a point of confusion. Customers, I'm not sure which one to buy. Obviously, some are a lot more expensive than the others. And when you get paralyzed with choice, a lot of times, you end up buying nothing.
Well, and especially with the new artwork and graphic design and all that, is very much trying to appeal to more of a family audience. Mm. The last thing you want to do with families, especially if they're relatively new to gaming, is make them feel intimidated, make them feel out of their depth.
Yeah.
You want to give them a welcoming entry point. And so just having the base game there and being like, this is what you need, is just way easier on some tired parents trying to buy a game.
Yeah. And it's not that I don't think those things should exist. Mm-hmm. And I think other stores may do well. If a store is more focused on, we need to have all the things for the more hardcore gamers, great.
Yeah.
But for us, we just want that ease of, this is Quacks. Let's not even talk about all the other options there are out there for you. It's a great game. We love it. You should buy it.
I want to circle back to licensed RPGs. Since, you know, I am one of the people who focuses on curating the RPG section, this Brandon Sanderson RPG, again, I don't know that property. I have no idea what this is about. None whatsoever. But customers sure do. You know, and so that's kind of a notable exception to me bringing that one in. But a lot of licensed RPGs I don't want to have in the store. They tend to use very generic systems. It tends to just feel like someone took their in-house proprietary system and slapped a theme onto it, slapped this license onto it. There's also the point that historically they don't tend to sell very well, just on a purely business side, the sort of lack of creativity that I often see with them aside, they do not tend to sell particularly well. I think because there is often not as much crossover as you might expect between fans of property X and people who are interested in diving headfirst into the deep end of running tabletop RPGs. So my big example for that is, and this is actually one we did bring in, but I will not be reordering, is the Cowboy Bebop RPG. And first of all, I want to say it's a beautiful book. And if you're a fan of Cowboy Bebop, it's a cool book just to have. It's got a lot of info on the setting. Just like I was saying before, these things can be like fun source books for fans of the material. But the game engine itself does not feel like it's custom built for the setting. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe the designer did sit down and think through how they want to make a Cowboy Bebop RPG. But to me, it felt like a fairly generic system. And there are better RPG systems out there that I would point to capture the feel of Cowboy Bebop. And if you're a huge fan of the anime series, you can just use one of these other systems and run a game set in the Cowboy Bebop universe just as easily. And I think have a better game experience with them. So if someone came in and said, hey, I love Cowboy Bebop, I want to run an RPG with that feel, believe it or not, I'm not going to point them first to the Cowboy Bebop RPG. I'm going to point them to a little indie RPG called See You Space Cowboy, which of course is a quote from Cowboy Bebop. So fans will immediately see what they're looking at there. But it is a nice, streamlined, narrative and character forward RPG that's actually, for a little tiny indie RPG, very well supported with supplements. But that system is, I think, going to be better for people who want a game that feels like Cowboy Bebop. Or Picaresque Roman, which is a great indie RPG. Again, a beautiful book. I mean, you want to talk about a gorgeous artifact to have on your shelves. Picaresque Roman is it, but very stylized. But that's a great cinematic system that's all about scoundrels. Maybe scoundrels with hearts of gold, but they're scoundrels. And boy, if that doesn't capture Cowboy Bebop, I don't know what does. So, I'm giving some positive examples of things I bring in instead right here, because I think it shows the logic. But I would, most of the time, I'm going to avoid licensed RPGs like the plague, because they do not often do what they say on the tin.
I do want to make sure every one of these episodes, we get a chance to just gush about games we've been enjoying lately. So let's end with that. I have been loving a little two-player card game from Brazil called Pipoca. This is a game we got in due to relationships in the industry. I am friends with Fel Barros. He used to work for CIMON. He's Brazilian. He started his own company in Brazil and really liked to get games in the US. So I said, hey, let's import some stuff and see what happens. So we just got three games from his company, Samba Studios. And Pipoca is the only one I've had a chance to play so far. But it's a two-player micro game. It's 18 cards, I believe. And you can play it without a table, just in your hands. Pipoca is the Portuguese word for popcorn. And you're trying to pop these popcorn kernels out of your popcorn bucket, out of the thing. It's a ladder climbing game. So someone's going to play a card from their hand. Maybe it's a four. The other player has to play something higher, or they could play a run, or two of a kind, three of a kind. But what's interesting is all the cards actually have four numbers on them, a top and a bottom, and then you flip the card over and a top and a bottom. So when someone beats your card, you get to upgrade. It starts popping. The curl starts popping. So now it was a four, and now you turn it over and it's a 12. And if I have that 12 out there and you beat it, I flip the card over and now it's two numbers. Maybe it's a five and a nine. So it gives me options and eventually becomes a wild. So the strategy of the game is looking at your cards and trying to pop them to the right number so you can make bigger sets and bigger runs to get rid of all your cards before the opponent does. It's super cute. I sat at the demo bar last week, played it with one of my kids that was in the store with me. I've sold a ton of copies of it. I love it. So that's what's been bringing me joy lately.
That's
what about you,
kind Chandra? Of a store favorite category right there is small games that pack a lot of interesting decisions. But for me, obviously, I'm going to have to talk about an RPG. I started running a campaign not too long ago of Outcast Silver Raiders. Comes in a beautiful three-book slipcase set from Exalted Funeral. Although it's not an in-house Exalted Funeral game, but it is a very old-school feeling, hex crawl, dungeon crawl style of game with a ton of interesting, like, faction politics in the game world. One of the things I love most about it, in addition to having a streamlined but very robust system, it has an amazing setting book. One of the three books, in fact, the thickest of the three books by a lot, is the setting guide. The actual rule book, very, very thick, really nice, easy to jump into thing. The referee's guide, the GM's guide, whatever you want to call it, is one of the best that I've ever read, especially for old school, you know, OSR, old school revival, old school Renaissance style gaming. Not every game has to be in that style, but if you're playing in that style, you cannot do better than reading that particular referee's manual for sort of philosophy on running that type. And the setting, the Mythic North, is basically like 11th or 12th century Scotland. So you've got, you know, the southern colonists, the southern imperial power coming in. You've got the northerners themselves, basically the Scottish, who, you know, have ruled this area for centuries and now are being pushed out, but trying to hold on to power and sort of forming a resistance or rebellion. You've got religious factions because it takes place on Earth. So the Catholic Church is the big religious power. And of course, they were as much political as they were religious, as much economic as well. Just a well-realized setting, and you can play it almost zero prep because of that book. It's got so many opportunities to travel around, roll on some random encounter tables, and for people who aren't familiar with the old-school style of play, that might sound a little dull, but rolling on those random encounter tables develops organic stories because these encounters pop up that get you involved in these factions, that get you to interact with the locations on the map for various reasons, and the player characters become more and more enmeshed in the setting, and it feels alive as you play because everything isn't planned out to a specific plot that you're pursuing. Everything feels very organic, and it's really easy to run. So my players and I have been having a ton of fun with that. If you're looking for a dark medieval, kind of low magic, but still magical setting, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's just a breeze at the table, but still so many interesting stories arise out of it as you play. But that's Outcast Silver Raiders.
Sounds like a lot of fun. All right. That's it for the first episode of the Unbox Some Funcast. Next time will be more of a freeform episode. Maybe Chandra and I just talking about what's been happening at the store over the past couple of weeks. And please like and subscribe. Is that a thing people do with podcasts, I suppose? tell your friends. If you know some game store owners, let them know, hey, this is a thing that's happening. Reach out to us.
Check out our weekly newsletter as well. That's a good way to stay informed about what's going on at the store, as well as when new podcast episodes are released.
Cool. All right. Until next time, this is the Unboxing Funcast. I'm Kylie.
And I'm Chandra.
And we are on the front line of the tabletop games industry. See you soon.